say it's alright. It's alright. Here comes the sun, little darling. Here comes the sun. I say it's alright. It's alright.
So, hey, everybody. Welcome to Voices from the Frontlines. You're on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, streaming live on the web at kpfk.org. Do check us out at www.voicesfromthefrontlines.com. It's a terrific website. You can download these shows. You hear it now, but you want to hear it again. Within a day, it's up on our site. You'll see all the back shows that we do. I think you know that we call Voices from the Frontlines your national movement-building show. As we say, we don't want just listener-sponsored radio. We want organizer-sponsored radio. We don't want you to just listen. We want you to act. So one of the exciting new actors on the show is somebody Channing and I met at the Historically Black Colleges and Universities Climate Justice Conference. We just returned from New Orleans in a very exciting panel. We heard a conversation between Dr. Reuben Patterson of Howard University, the chair of the sociology department. He was talking about the need to more integrate climate studies and climate politics into Africana studies. The other panelist was Dr. Gregory Jenkins, who's on the line with us now. And he was doing real frontline work, describing the work in Africa, where he is working on preparedness systems. He was in Cape Verde Islands. He brought us, it was like the Black Weather Channel. It was really great. So, Greg, very happy to have you on Voices from the Frontlines.
Thank you. Very glad to be here.
Greg, I'm just going to read a little of your background. Normally, we don't do a lot of background, but this is pretty impressive, and it helps our listeners listen. So, Gregory Jenkins is a native of Philadelphia, is currently a professor in the Department of Meteorology at Penn State University. He's director of the Alliance for Education, Sciences, Engineering, and Development in Africa in the Office of Global Programs. So first of all, tell us about AESEDA. What is it?
So the point of ESEDA is to bring together students, faculty, and others who can help in addressing some of the challenges that face the continent. And it's not just one discipline. It's across the board. So from the social sciences to the medical sciences to, again, science and engineering, we need everyone to help with the very serious challenges that exist on the continent.
One of the things that's great about your work is you are a meteorologist. And, again, we were very impressed in your work in the Eye of the Storm. One of the things that I wanted to ask you about is in my book, Katrina's Legacy, I did a lot of studying about, for instance, the increase from, at this point, theoretically 0.85 degrees Celsius to what seems very clear it's going to exceed 2 and probably move to 3. One of the things that I studied about is that if it moves to 3 degrees Celsius, that all of sub-Saharan Africa may be an actual extreme desert. And I was dealing with issues of, you know, food deprivation and mass starvation. But one of the things that I got out of your conversation is another area of your work is on the issue of monsoons and floods and storms. Why don't you tell us about that element of the climate threat to Africa?
Well, what we have been observing over the last decade or so after a period of very below normal rainfall is a return to above normal rainfall in many places. However, the caveat is that it's not raining more frequently, but when it does rain, it pours and is very intense. And in fact, many of our regional climate models are now pointing to this as a likely outcome, that Africa will actually become drier, but when it rains, watch out. And you know, with growing cities and a population that's probably going to double in West Africa and by 2050, this is neither good news for farmers nor urban dwellers.
Well, tell us about the level of preparedness and the actual work you're doing on the ground, because, again, I was studying about droughts and floods and the cycle, as you were saying. Are there going to be monsoons? Or is there going to be much more rapid winds? Tell us what it's going to look like.
Well, in the interior, we're going to be looking at both drying conditions, but again, when it rains, it will flood. And that will be, again, a major impact in the interior. Now, along coastal regions, and if you want to think downstream to the Caribbean and New Orleans and East Coast of the U.S., the real question is about the tropical cyclones. Now, the cyclones, they come about mostly from these waves, these African easterly waves. They come by every 3 to 5 days. They move from east to west, and then probably about 1 out of 10 will become some named storm in the summertime, especially in August and September. There are indications that we're going to see an upswing, and we have been seeing it really since 95. We're going to see an upswing in these storms as we progress through this century. But more importantly, the waters will be warmer, so the potential for strong storms, and as recently Jim Hansen said, superstorms will become possible, along with the issue of rising sea level. In my opinion, there are no safe zones from West Africa all the way through the Americas. People are going to have to be prepared. But as you know, Africa is the least prepared and least adaptable at this point for climate change. And so it's really a struggle. And I might say that what Africa has experienced since 1970 is probably one of the biggest climate signals on the planet. And it has caused millions of people to migrate into cities. So it's happening now. And some of the pictures that I showed, or some of the things that I showed, was, you know, in these coastal zones, coastal villages in Senegal, and I mean, these villages were wiped out. And I talked to people on the ground. They said they have never seen anything like this before. And one man told me, he said he's 100% sure that the sea is going to come and take everything from them. Another woman who lived in Dakar, along the coastal zone, a fishing village there, said she'd been there for 4 years, and she'd never seen the sea rise like that. They said the sea was 3 to 4 meters. It took their houses. It took everything from them. They had no warning whatsoever.
Well, one thing, again, the voice you're listening to is Gregory Jenkins, and he's right now with the Department of Meteorology at Penn State University, and again, the Alliance for Education, Sciences, Engineering, and Development in Africa. I mean, obviously, both in my book, Katrina's Legacy, but all the work I've done since 1964, we've talked about the beauty of Africa and how it's been raped and pillaged by U.S. imperialism, all the forms of extracting labor, extracting human beings, extracting raw materials, and now inflicting, after extracting, inflicting pain back on Africa, none of which was caused by Africa. What's the politics of this in terms of the African nations? How organized are they on issues of climate, and what demands are they placing on the governments?
Well, I think that there's a certain unified thought that there needs to be help in dealing with not only climate change now, but in the future. The real struggle is, to me, around the cost of the damages that will come from climate change and are currently happening, and the attribution piece. So how do you attribute climate change to, let's say, flooding in Burkina Faso in 2009? That's the real struggle. I don't think it's an impossible struggle, but the problem is that the number of observations on the ground are limited, extremely limited, and the reports of the damage are not thorough quite often, they are coming from media. The government may or may not be reporting all of the damages, all of the fatalities that are actually occurring at this point in time because of extremes in weather, which are likely driven by the larger anthropogenic climate forcing, especially on the ocean. So that's going to be the struggle, and we really need to build an observing system across all of Africa so that, number one, we can document what's going to happen over this century. We can learn from what we're seeing about how to move people out of danger zones. And for those countries that will be looking at the, you know, damages, you know, they'll have the actual evidence to support that.
Well, one thing, Greg, is that, you know, I just came back, as I think you were there also, but we were at the United Nations Climate Change Conference in Paris, and one of the big roles that the Obama administration plays was they took language and said that they will not address issues of so-called loss and damages, and that they wanted essentially to sign off any issues of liability. My response is, well, that's just a political reality that can be changed, you know, if the African movement is stronger. So we can continue to place, that's one of the reasons we've been calling on the United States government to contribute at least $10 billion a year into the Green Climate Fund to allow nations of Africa, for instance, to build the kind of structures that you're saying they need to build. Tell us somewhat about, given that, the work that you're doing on the ground, because, you know, if the African countries are having problems adapting because of depleted economies, what is your work look like as essentially a climate organizer in Africa?
I have started to work across disciplines, and there are several things that I spend my time on. We have built forecasting tools that our colleagues can use to look at this extreme weather. We've also been looking at weather climate health issues, especially as it relates to Saharan dust and biomass burning and things like that that we know are killing people, causing lots of respiratory disease every year. So the way I'm looking at the problem is we have to build an observing infrastructure, but then we have to connect all the parts together. We've got to keep people out of danger, especially if they're living on the front line, as many are. Many, many people in West Africa and Africa as a whole are not seen. They live in very difficult conditions, and we have to protect them. I feel like we have a moral obligation to protect them, and that's what I do. I'm on the ground. That's where I stay. The villages out in the rural areas, they're extremely vulnerable, and they don't have power, many don't have water, and therefore food security is a big issue. I'm thinking about how do we build systems of adaptability. And so for food security, and then thinking about greenhouses, and greenhouses provide farmers with a much better sense of I'm able to grow this much in a certain period of time. They use less water because there's just less evaporation. And you can grow food outside of the wet season. And typically in many locations in Africa, you're only going to get 3 or 4 months of rain, and then it's going to be dry. But the greenhouses allow you to potentially grow food throughout the entire year. Now, water is an issue. So we've got to be thinking about water storage and other forms of getting water to improve the food security. But I do feel like the situation is very, what would you say, unstable in terms of weather at this point. Last year was an El Nino year, and in West Africa, we normally see dry conditions. But there was lots of flooding, and of course, Cape Verde was hit by a hurricane last year. So no one was expecting that. And that's what I mean. I think as we look out over the next just decade, I think we're going to be dealing with a number of very extreme conditions that come about because the climate is in a transition mode. And the people know things are changing. They don't know what to do.
Well, I think one of the things that, you know, I don't know if this is the right word, is adaptation. I've never liked that in some way because, you know, it's sort of saying the U.S. government is saying, well, we're going to create the global warming and you have to adapt. But I think the reality is that adaptation is a very important question in Africa, since a lot of these things, as we're going to try to stop them politically, as we're going to try to stop, keep the coal in the ground, keep the oil in the ground. The reality is that that this is already baked into the system. There is going to be more storms, more droughts, more floods. So in terms of your interdisciplinary work, give me a picture of all the different things that could be done at the level of adaptation. One you've already pointed out is warning, building up warning systems. The second, you're talking about food security, moving towards tell me some of these others you've talked, you've implied about public health issues of. So let's keep talking about this hypothetical dream team that we would put together of the disciplines to address all the impacts of global warming in Africa.
So here's the good news. It's just not organized. The good news is cell phone technology allows us to be many places at one time. But we need a network so that the information can flow through to important decision makers, whether they're at hospitals or, you know, civil authorities that need to protect people, or just getting a sense of how things are emerging. You know, how many, you know, floods are we seeing? How many fatalities are we seeing? If we're talking about respiratory disease, West Africa is a large area just to the south of the Sahara, is called the meningitis belt. And we're pretty sure that dust, Sahara dust, we have these big dust storms about every 3 to 5 days there in the wintertime. They bring lots of very poor air quality conditions across almost all of the West African cities. And these particles also contain pathogens on them. So here's an example. I'm an atmospheric scientist. I'm working with a microbiologist. I'm working with hospitals in Senegal. We are forecasting dust storms, and we're working with the Ministry of Environment. They have an air quality center. We all work together to look at the air quality levels in Dakar, the capital of the country, because we have seen, for example, 2012, it wasn't a meningitis outbreak, but there were lots of people who came down with them. And we also found that dust levels were much, much higher during that period than in years where we see low levels. If you go towards the interior of the country, places like Burkina Faso, they've had about 10,000 meningitis cases per year. We do not know what is driving it, but the environment is likely playing a part in it. If you go south towards places like Ivory Coast or Côte d'Ivoire, biomass burning is, and smoke is everywhere, and it is killing people on an annual basis. The estimates are somewhere above 100,000 folks in sub-Saharan Africa die from poor air quality from biomass burning. So that's a land management issue that could be dealt with. And then you have indoor cooking. You know, people cook and the levels of particulate matter are extremely high. The women are in there cooking and they're taking in a lot of bad black carbon, and it's going into their respiratory system. This could just be a simple issue of, look, we need to ventilate better. We need to create solar ovens, which exist already, and we need to keep people aware of this issue of what you're taking into your lungs.
And Greg,
yeah.
I'm sorry, this is great. I wanted to make sure, as we're running out of time, you did an amazing PowerPoint that I want to see if I even understood correctly, where you were trying to, as I understood it, somehow, through some kind of a computer model, you did every single transatlantic slave ship that left Africa for both the Caribbean and the United States. Is that correct?
Actually, that came out of a Washington Post article. All they did was show the routes. Remember, the ship routes were known, and they pretty much showed that there were 20,000 ships from 1555 to 1860, and they showed the locations of where they left Africa. So when we were looking at that animation, it was actually showing us those ship routes. Those were real ship routes.
Well, that's terrific.
And I can send you the source on that.
Well, that was very moving, and I think to conclude, I want to say, because I'd like to have you back, that I think the work you've done to try to show the relationship of the transatlantic slave trade, to show the relationship of, as you say, the interdisciplinary nature of it, to bring really hard science and really hard politics together, is a great contribution. I want to thank you for your work. I want to have you back on Voices. I want to get to know you more and actually work with you in the real world. What's your last thought for our listeners?
The last thought is that we have to remain aware and we have to act. We have to keep the carbon down to a level where it's not going to damage future generations all around the world. And we have to be aware of the things that are happening around us. Just notice the level of extreme weather, and it's not coincidental. So we need to stay very aware of what's happening just with nature, but also with the current political environment.
Greg Jenkins, thank you so much for being Voices on the Front Lines. Take good care of yourself.
Thanks, Eric. You do the same.
All right. So that was Dr. Gregory Jenkins with the Department of Meteorology at Penn State University, and again, a real contributor to the Voices from the Front Lines.
Here comes the sun, little darling. Here comes the sun.